This is Teddy Roosevelt, just back from charging up San Juan Hill. Damn it, Professor Buzzkill was already at the top, collecting historical evidence, busting myths, and taking names. I have to admit that he's a worthy competitor and a damn fine rough rider. Join me in listening to this episode. It's sure to be bully.
A while ago in the late 20th century, I was a junior year abroad student in Europe, you know, doing my best to find some direction in life. It was an especially high and noisy time for American patriotism in that decade. And I remember distinctly one night in the college bar being asked by a fellow student what, if anything, made me proud to be an American. Birthright citizenship jumped out of my mouth before I knew it. Not something vague like freedom or world leadership. Birthright citizenship. The fact that anyone born in the United States or its territories was automatically a citizen. I can't remember how my drinking companion replied or how we talked about it, but I was reminded of my reaction to that patriotism and pride question all those years ago when the issue of birthright citizenship arose during the 2018 congressional elections. As you know, President Trump railed against it in an obvious attempt to rally his base, and the talk radio circus clowns, you know, they got in on the act. Now, the issue burned brightly for a while and was promptly dropped after Election Day, having served its purpose, no doubt. But 1,000 lies and misstatements of fact were dumped on the American public, and an awful lot of that flow of fact-free garbage, frankly, was based on a total lack of knowledge about what birthright citizenship was and is, and how it came to be so strongly held in American civic life. The debates on immigration to the United States continue now, of course, for all sorts of reasons, and the issue of birthright citizenship often comes up, sometimes in the context of anchor babies, that offensive term used to refer to children of immigrants born in the United States. You know, the implication being that the birth was planned deliberately to take place in the U.S. in order to help immigrant parents settle and stay in the country. But before we get to the history of birthright citizenship and how it's been used in the United States, let me get a little legal lingo explained and, you know, out of the way. There are two main ways that citizenship in a nation is attained in most countries in the world. One is naturalization. A person lives in a country for a certain period of time, applies to become a citizen based on that residency, and maybe has to pass a basic test on the country's laws and forms of government. You know, that sort of thing. But this episode isn't about naturalization. It's about the other way to citizenship, that is through birth. Now, there are two, I keep saying these things, it gets more complicated. There are two types of automatic citizenship through birth, one being born in a country, and the other being born to a parent who is a citizen of a certain country. Different countries use one or the other types of birth citizenship practice, and some, like the U.S., use both. In most parts of the world, being born to a parent who's a citizen of a country makes you a citizen of that country, no matter where you were born, geographically speaking. A child born in Kenya, for instance, would be an American citizen by birth if one of that child's parents was an American citizen. A child born in Canada becomes an American citizen by birth if one of that child's parents is an American citizen. This Canadian example explains why Senator Ted Cruz was eligible to run for president of the United States despite being born in Calgary. Cruz's father was Cuban, but his mother was an American citizen, and lovable, cuddly Ted is therefore an American citizen by birth. For the same reason, if the stories of Barack Obama being born in Kenya had been true, he would have been an American citizen by birth because his mother was an American citizen. The Constitution, as you know, insists that a president must be a citizen by birth, and therefore Obama would have been eligible to run and serve as president. But of course, he was born in Hawaii. Therefore, he was an American citizen by jus sanguinis, that is the right of blood, through his mother, and jus soli, the right of the soil, because he was born in American territory. Now, sorry about the lingo in Latin, and I'm sure my Latin isn't very good, but those are the two basic ways, jus sanguinis and jus soli. Generally speaking, very few people object to the jus sanguinis, the parentage root of citizenship. But I said a little earlier that attacks on the concept of jus solis, the right of citizenship by place of birth, crop up every now and then, especially when political emotions and tensions are heightened, you know, during elections, for example. And generally speaking, again, those attacks are based on almost a complete misunderstanding of what the right to citizenship by place of birth means and how it's been developed and sustained constitutionally and historically, at least in the United States. And of course, explaining the history behind these kinds of things is what you pay me for. So here's how that happened. In the first place, despite what President Trump says and what candidate Trump said so often, it's simply not true that the United States is the, quote, only country that grants citizenship automatically to children born here. Roughly half the world does, including our closest neighbors, Canada and Mexico. But some European countries grant citizenship by parentage and by geographic birth. Again, what does the U.S. use? Both, as a matter of fact. Both jus soli, the right of the soil, geographic birthplace, and jus sanguinis, right of blood by parentage. That's simple. So why does the issue and the reaction to it interest us here at the Buzzkill Institute? Well, because the history of citizenship in the U.S. is very, very complicated, and the various ways it's been addressed bears on so many other aspects of American history, especially the status of Native Americans, the status of slaves, and the status of freed slaves after emancipation, and the status of immigrants. Now, I wish I could tell you that the Founding Fathers enshrined birthright citizenship both by parentage and by birthplace in the U.S. Constitution right off the bat, but they didn't. In short, citizenship was granted to any, quote, free person already living in one of the original colonies and to any free person subsequently born in the new United States, one of the states. Of course, the fact that slaves were not free persons excluded them from citizenship. This was based on the legal doctrine, and again, I'm sorry for more Latin, and I'm even sorrier for my Latin pronunciation, the legal document of partus sequitur ventrum, which means, and I'm quoting here, believe it or not, that which is brought forth from the womb. Children born of an unfree mother brought their mother's citizenship status with them. They were slaves, essentially, from birth. Now, notice I said unfree mother. This meant that it didn't matter who the father was. A slave woman's child was born a slave. Yeah, that means that children sired by a free father, slave owner, overseer, or any other free man, but born to a slave mother was a slave. You see what I'm getting at here, right? Most historians believe that Thomas Jefferson and his slave Sally Hemings had six children together. But all of those children were born slaves and not citizens, even though their father was a free white man and one of the founders of the country in which they were born. Birthright citizenship for slaves, for former slaves, and for freed peoples wasn't settled until the passage of the Civil Rights Act of 1866 and the ratification of the 14th Amendment in 1868. And essentially, it took the Union victory in the Civil War and the passage of the Emancipation Proclamation in 1863 to kind of put that issue at the heart of the American Constitution. But it was a close run and controversial thing before the Civil War. the famous, or infamous, depending on who you talk to, 1857 Dred Scott decision by the Supreme Court said that African Americans could never become citizens of the United States because, in the court's majority view at the time, the Constitution did not guarantee it to them. Even those who were free, former slaves, freedmen, or freed black persons born in the North, for instance. Now, the Dred Scott case deserves a show of its own, and we'll probably do one. But essentially, here's what happened. In a 10-year legal case starting in 1846 that eventually ended up in the Supreme Court in 1857, as I said, Dred Scott, the slave of an army officer, tried to gain his freedom by arguing that he had lived with his master in a free state, Illinois, and a free territory, Wisconsin, for 4 years. The Supreme Court ruled against him in 7-2 vote, saying that, quote, a Negro whose ancestors were imported into the U.S. and sold as slaves could not be an American citizen, no matter if he himself was free or was still a slave. It was obviously a purely racial decision. And the arguments about it, for it, against it, after it happened, you know, really helped keep the issue in the national debate alive for the rest of the 1850s and 1860s. For example, in 1862, the U.S. Attorney General, Edward Bates, wrote that the Constitution, quote, recognizes and reaffirms the universal principle common to all nations and as old as political society, that the people born in a country do constitute a nation, and as individuals are natural members of the body politic. And I'm continuing this long quote here, but it's a really good one. It follows that every person born in a country is, at the moment of birth, prima facie a citizen, and who would deny it must take upon himself the burden of proving some great disenfranchisement strong enough to override the natural born right as recognized by the Constitution in terms the most simple and comprehensive, and without any reference to race or color or any other accidental circumstance, end quote. Now, Bates, he had written this in a response to a letter from the Treasury Secretary, Samuel Chase, who had written to him asking about the citizenship status of free African Americans. And I think it represents the growing change that Bates's response, that is, represents the growing change in government opinion between the Dred Scott decision, 1857, and the early years of the Civil War. Now, two further decisions more or less sealed the matter. As I said, during Reconstruction, Congress passed the Civil Rights Act of 1866, which said, quote, all persons born in the United States and not subject to any foreign power, excluding Indians not taxed, are hereby declared to be citizens of the United States. Notice that it said Indians not taxed. This, in essence, meant Native Americans living on tribal reservations. But keep this exclusion in mind because it's important, and we'll get to it after the break. And of course, after the Civil Rights Act of 1866, the most important government statement about birthright citizenship was the 14th Amendment to the Constitution, which was ratified in 1868. It said, quote, all persons born or naturalized in the United States and subject to the jurisdiction thereof are citizens of the United States and of the state wherein they reside. You would think that was as clear and direct as it could be. But as we'll see after the break, history rarely lets us off that easy. Back in a minute.
Hello, this is Antonia Buzzkill. Please support my daddy by going to ProfessorBuzzkill.com and clicking on the Patreon button. While you're there, subscribe to his email list and shop the Buzzkill bookshelf. Follow him on Facebook, on Twitter at BuzzkillProf, and on Instagram at ProfessorBuzzkill. Professor Buzzkill is part of Entertainment One's podcast network, and is available on iTunes, Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Google Play, and all major podcast apps. Please leave a review while you're there. Thanks for listening.
During the first half of the show, I kept using terms like native-born, natural-born, and born in the United States. You would think that, at the very least, those concepts would apply to the original native-born inhabitants of what became the United States. But as you might have guessed when I mentioned, quote, Indians not taxed, unquote, who were left out of the Civil Rights Act of 1866, the legal citizenship status of Native Americans was not as clear and obvious as it should have been. In what's bound to be one of the biggest ironies, saddest ironies in American history, especially regarding birthright citizenship, Native Americans, indigenous peoples, were not, both generally and technically speaking, citizens of the United States. At least not until 1924, nearly 50 years after the 14th Amendment was added to the Constitution. And in some ways, the history of their path to citizenship is more complicated than that of African American slaves and their descendants. That's because the Constitution in Article 1 defined categories of persons to be counted in each state's population for the purposes of determining the number of representatives that state would be granted in the House of Representatives. Originally, the idea was to count only white people. But since the white population of southern slaveholding states was so much smaller than the white populations of northern states, the white free populations, obviously, the famous three-fifths compromise was adopted. In addition to the number of free white people in a state, the new Constitution allowed southern states to count three-fifths of their slaves in their total population statistic for congressional representation. They didn't grant these slaves three-fifths of citizenship rights or anything, or three-fifths of anything, for that matter. It was a pure political deal to get the slave states to ratify the Constitution, because they thought they'd be swamped by the larger northern states in terms of representation in Congress. At the same time, the Constitution excluded, quote, Indians not taxed in a state's population total. Essentially, this meant Native Americans who lived on tribal lands and who had made agreements or treaties with states to be recognized as Indian nations, those Native Americans were not to be considered citizens. These were the Indians not taxed, which obviously was different from the Indians who were taxed. Indians who were taxed, if you will, were Native Americans who had more or less left their tribal lands and traditions and who had started to live in white society. They were to be considered citizens, and their children were to be considered citizens. This is part of the highly complicated history of U.S. government relations with indigenous people. For all sorts of reasons, many Native Americans lived as their own nations and were regarded by the U.S. government, the new U.S. government anyway, as a kind of separate nations within the boundaries of the U.S., if you know what I mean. But those people were not granted rights by the American government and, as you undoubtedly know, were more or less treated however the government wanted to treat them at whatever time. Indian wars and other incursions were made whenever westward expansion brought Eastern white Americans into the West. Now, obviously, these topics deserve shows of their own, as well as the other shows of their own I mentioned earlier. But the specific citizenship question for Native Americans wasn't a quiet one during the 19th century. During the time that the citizenship status of African Americans was being debated, the citizenship status of Native Americans was being debated. While he was still general of the army after the Civil War and later when he was president, Ulysses S. Grant tried to change and, you know, to his mind, improve relations between the federal government and Native American groups and nations. Grant, in doing this, seems to have been motivated by at least two things. The first was his gratitude towards Native Americans who had served in the Union Army, especially his military secretary, Eli Parker, who was from the Seneca Nation. The second was the distressing reports he kept getting back about the behavior of some white settlers in the West. You know, migrant farmers and cattlemen were encroaching on Native American land. Railroads were being built on contested land. Miners often didn't respect land boundaries, and there were all kinds of fights and battles and small Indian wars. Calling Native Americans, quote, the original occupants of the land in his 1869 inaugural address, Grant envisioned a future in which they would become eligible for full citizenship. This would happen, Grant thought and argued, through a process by which Native Americans would be allowed, in fact, they'd be encouraged to participate in white American society and gradually trade their ancestral lands and traditions for the benefits of what was then modern white American life. But even this highly, you know, assimilationist approach to citizenship for Native Americans was too much for most of the Congress and most government elites. More or less the entire course of his presidency, Grant's various attempts to open up military and other government positions to Native Americans were thwarted by congressional opposition. Not only that, significant numbers of Native Americans, especially leaders of tribes and nations, opposed what they saw as having United States citizenship, if you will, forced on them. Not only, you know, were they understandably suspicious of overtures and promises from the U.S. government about anything, they worried that assimilation would eventually kill off their Native American culture and identity. And the supremacy of tribal citizenship over U.S. citizenship seemed to be confirmed by the Supreme Court in 1884. John Elk, a Native American from the Winnebago Nation, tried to renounce his tribal citizenship and claim U.S. citizenship in order to vote in 1880. The court decided that Elk owed his true allegiance to his tribe and that that allegiance prevented him from sincerely desiring U.S. citizenship. Therefore, the court denied John Elk's U.S. citizenship claim. But for the next 40 years, debates went back and forth about whether Native Americans were a special case because of this idea that they couldn't have divided loyalties between their tribes and nations and between and the U.S. government. And it's pretty clear that at least from the anti-Native American citizenship side among white Americans, this was all based on race and ethnicity. Practically no one, for instance, claimed that European immigrants in the 19th century could be denied naturalized citizenship based on any prior allegiance to France or Italy or wherever. But hold on to this thought, Buzzkillers, because it'll come up again before the show's over. Okay, so Native American citizenship in the United States wasn't finally settled until, well, more or less the middle of the 20th century. Well within, that is, living memory. The Indian Citizenship Act of 1924, passed over some white opposition and Native American opposition, said, quote, that all non-citizen Indians born within the territorial limits of the United States and they are hereby declared to be citizens of the United States. Just like Grant had thought back in the years after the Civil War, there was a lot of grateful sentiment towards Native Americans who had served in the U.S. military during World War I, and that was sort of behind the push for the 1824 Act and also pressure from progressives and reformers in the early 19th century who wanted to improve relations with Native Americans. But see, you see, the 1924 Act only made citizenship provision for Native Americans born after it was enacted. It's just so complicated and fraud. It's just unbelievable. It wasn't until the Nationality Act of 1940, that all persons born in the United States, even those born before 1924, were granted birthright citizenship. Even then, some states withheld voting rights and other rights for Native Americans. And this practice lasted until it was finally abandoned by those states in 1948. Again, that's well within the living memory of at least my parents' generation. As I said earlier, most historians of the late 19th century and early 20th century believe that opposition to Native American citizenship was based on race and bigotry against those groups. You'd be quite right in shouting at your radio or your computer or your mobile phone or whatever it is you listen to this podcast on, that this represented a great hypocrisy. Immigrants from other parts of the world weren't held to the same loyalty standards as Native Americans who desired citizenship. Well, yes and no. And I'll finish up this episode by briefly explaining the 1898 Supreme Court case of United States versus Wong Kim Ark, which was more or less the Supreme Court case that provided the strongest and most strongly worded precedent for what we now consider birthright citizenship. Born in San Francisco in 1873 to Chinese immigrants, Wong Kim Ark would normally have been considered a U.S. citizen because he was born here, as the idea of jus soli, which we mentioned at the beginning of this whole, the right of the soil, had it. But Chinese immigrants, like Wong Kim Ark's parents, in the late 19th century faced a great deal of racial discrimination, and U.S. citizenship was denied to them on the, frankly, somewhat technical grounds that the Emperor of China still regarded them as subjects. And they were, again, technically under his control. Again, no serious scholar doubts that these U.S. restrictions were based on racism towards Chinese immigrants, and that they only used the, quote, worst subjects of the Emperor of China as a sort of rationalization. In late 1894, Wong Kim Ark went on a trip to China, and when he tried to return home to San Francisco in early 1895, he was denied entry into the U.S. based on the laws, you know, then current, that were trying to curb the rate of Chinese immigration. He'd been born in the United States. And Wong Kim Ark sued in court, arguing he was a natural-born American citizen, should have been let in the country in a normal way. Now, his case worked its way up through the state courts and the federal courts until it reached the Supreme Court in 1898. And the court ruled in Wong Kim Ark's favor, and he was admitted back to the United States and permitted to exercise his citizenship. Now, even though chronologically this Supreme Court decision came before the Indian Citizenship Act of 1924 and the subsequent laws relating to it in the 1940s, I want to end this show with the Wong Kim Ark case because of the specific language used in the decision and the rhetorical power with which it was expressed by its author, who was Associate Justice Horace Gray. That language provided such strong support for the legal and constitutional fact that birthright citizenship in the United States means exactly that, birthright citizenship. Again, I'm quoting here. The 14th Amendment affirms the ancient and fundamental rule of citizenship by birth within the territory, in the allegiance and under the protection of the country, including all children here born of resident aliens. The amendment, in clear words and in manifest intent, includes the children born within the territory of the United States or of all other persons of whatever race or color domiciled within the United States, end quote. And even though it gets questioned and challenged sometimes, birthright citizenship has been constantly reaffirmed by the Supreme Court and championed by sane and sensible voices in our country. In the last few years, we seem to be living in the shadow of increased hatred and discrimination in the United States. And I just hope that, at least as far as birthright citizenship is concerned, and as far as many other things are concerned, we're able to overcome that angst and live up to this vital American principle. And I take a great deal of American pride in the fact that my feeling on this and the strength with which I hold it hasn't changed since I expressed it as a college student in a foreign land all those years ago. Talk to you next week.